Hello, this is Pete Rizzo from Checkbook IRA. And today we're lucky to have Gary Mobbs from South Star Bank, located in Moulton, Texas. Gary is a senior vice president and he's in charge of their non-recourse lending for South Star. South Star has been, around for quite a while and started in, gosh, I have it down here, but it was like the 1920s, wasn't it, Gary?
Yes, it was 1920. We're going to celebrate our 104th anniversary this coming October.
Well, that's super for all the ups and downs of banks. For somebody celebrating that centennial anniversary, it's pretty special. And so I'll say, they've started the SDIRA, their self-directed loan program, about 5 years ago. And they primarily were in Texas, but now in 2022, they expanded their lending footprint on non-recourse IRA loans and solo 401k loans. So we're going to talk about that today, some of the rules and the differences. And Gary's been in banking for 27 years and with South Star for 20. 1994 graduate of Texas A&M and 2015 graduate of Southwestern Graduate School of Banking. He's in Gonzales, Texas right now, if you want to get a hold of Gary. We're down here. And that branch was built in 2009. So again, thank you for your time and spending a little bit of time with us and answering some questions today, Gary.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well that and as everybody who's listening to this is self-directed IRAs or solo 401ks, if you don't know, a lot of you do know, but you have to. Anytime you get financing for real estate to buy real estate with a self-directed IRA or solo 401k, the loan has to be non-recourse. And it's different than the normally going into your bank or getting a mortgage. So, Gary, what exactly is non-recourse financing? How is it different from recourse financing?
Well, basically, in a non-recourse loan, you can only go after the asset itself, and there's no recourse against the guarantor or borrower. Like with a full recourse loan, if someone comes in, they make a loan on a piece of real estate, they sign the note, and the bank has full rights in the event of default. If we foreclose on the property and there was a shortfall, we have full rights to come after any assets that are, any non-exempt assets that the borrower has, in order to try to collect on that debt and make the bank whole. In a non-recourse scenario, we just go after the asset itself. So in an IRA, IRAs are protected,
Right.
and anything in the IRA. So we would, if you held a piece of real estate in the IRA and we loan money on that piece of real estate, we could only come after, in the event of default, the particular asset that we have collateral on. We could not come after any of the other assets of the IRA.
Okay, or the owner or anybody else. It's
Yes.
just that type of client. But I think a lot of people don't realize that when they sign a home mortgage, that the bank could come back after them if there's a shortfall, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And it seems like you don't see that as much in, for home mortgages, but in commercial real estate and that sort of thing seems to be more prevalent.
Yeah,
But
especially, people do commercial real estate loans and then they'll guarantee it. And a lot of times, they don't realize that, if they default, the bank does have the right to come after all the guarantors.
right. Okay. And now what type of assets can be used as collateral for a non-recourse financing?
Well, we pretty much stick to one to four family. I mean, there may be some other lenders out there that'll do commercial, but we pretty much try to stick with one to four family, keep it pretty simple. I have done a few deals where somebody's had a unique, property that, like, I did a deal in Missouri here not too long ago where the borrower had six individual homes on one property. And then they also had like a storage unit facility in the front of it. And that, we did that particular loan. It made sense. I mean, the borrower had a considerable amount of equity into it. So, You know, it was kind of a one-off deal, but we try to stay with a 1-4 family, you know, for the most part.
Do you, well, you know, and talking about that, that where you have the ability to kind of look at a loan and saying, this doesn't fit the criteria, but it makes sense. It makes sense for us. Are these all portfolio loans that you do, or you try, or do you try and sell the loans afterwards?
No, these are all portfolio loans. We keep them and service them right here in our bank.
Okay. Okay. For people that are listening there, wonder what I was talking about with portfolio loans. A lot of times banks will package loans and then sell them afterwards. They get set to selling, so they have to meet certain criteria. Portfolio loans, the bank can, I know there's guidelines for you you have to follow, but the bank has more leeway to approve or not approve a loan. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Now, is there a loan to value you typically use with the non-recourse loans?
Yeah, because it is a non-recourse loan, typically the down payment is higher. You know, that's kind of how we mitigate our risk. And so on these non-recourse loans, our maximum loan to value is 60%. So they would have to have 40%, you know, down payment out of their IRA.
Okay. Or now, can they refinance with a non-recourse loan? Say you they've got a
Go ahead. Yeah, they can do a cash out refi. If they have a problem, they want to pull money out of it and use that to buy something else, that's perfectly allowed too.
Okay. And that would meet the same 60-40 ratio.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And that, now do you, what type of appraisal? Does it have to be a certified appraisal, or do you have appraisers around the area that do those?
I mean, we use a regular state certified appraiser. You know, anything that's out of state, we have to go through an AMC, which is an appraisal management company, and they help us, you know, coordinate finding an appraiser. But it's, you know, we do get a regular state certified appraiser to do the appraisal. Okay. The only thing that we add to it, because when we underwrite one of these, we're underwriting the cash flow of the property itself for the repayment of the loan. And so we do try to get an appraisal schedule added to the appraisal, just so that we can see what the market rent for the appraisal, you know, for the market rent should be per the appraisal. And we use that kind of as our benchmark, you know, for underwriting the loan.
Right. And for people that are listening that don't, you know, or kind of, I'm not going to say they don't know what you're talking about, but don't, haven't put those two together. You know, it's a little bit different that the, you know, they look at if the property can support the loan.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Where, you know, so, it has to be, you know, support the loan where you can't, you know, say your rents are three times higher than they normally would. You know, there's actual figures out now to be able to show, you know, show what the average rents are in the area. And I'm sure, too, a lot of times they probably even have a rental history with it.
Yes.
With a specific property.
Some properties, you know, do.
Now, does that help? Does that help if they have a, you know, like say they can show you, okay, here's the rents that we've got over the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, that definitely helps.
Okay.
And if they had a lease in place, you know, let's just say they're buying the property and there's a lease in place and it clearly shows what the property is being rented for, we will use that, you know, as our benchmark for qualification. We would use that over, you know, what the appraiser might come up with. So if the appraiser comes up with, you know, let's just say the lease that's in place on the property is at $2,000 a month, and the appraiser says, okay, well, you know, average market rent should be $1,900 a month, I'm going to use the lease that's in place to qualify. Okay.
Yeah, I would imagine today that's kind of maybe even a little bit tricky taking a look at it because there's so much conversations. I know here in Arizona and the Phoenix area, there's a lot of conversations about rents being overinflated and landlords doing that sort of thing. But if you got a lease, that's gonna make it a lot safer, I guess, to make the loan. How about the interest rates and the prepayment terms? Are they different? What's you know, kind of the average, or is it a few percent above prime, or 15-30? How is it on there?
So We'll amortize all of our loans over 30 years.
Okay.
These are all set up on ARMs as ARMs. So adjustable rate mortgage, if people don't know what ARM is. We can lock the rate. We've got two different rate options right now. One of them is a 3-year and the other is a 5-year, which means that the rate, you know, is initially locked for either a 3 or 5 year term. And then it can adjust at Wall Street Journal Prime plus 2% after that.
Okay.
And then, you know, we do put a cap on it. And then we do it. So it wouldn't adjust more than 2%, you know, at any adjustment period. If it did go up, it wouldn't adjust by more than 2%, and it couldn't go up by more than 6% over the life of the loan. So there is some caps in there. And right now, just, you know, we're doing on our 3-1 ARM, it's, you know, we're currently doing that rate at about 8.43%. Not terribly higher than, you know, what the normal market would be like on a personal loan. But it is about, you know, 1.5% or so higher. On a 5-year, we're doing those at about 8.93. You know, those rates are subject to change, but, and I've told a lot of people here recently, you know, that we've underwritten that, you know, at some point down the road, we may offer, you know, even a 7 or maybe the option of a 10-year, but, you know, that's going to be probably after, you know, this rate environment stabilizes a little bit and, you know, things kind of get back to where they were before. So we're trying to keep everything, you know, kind of short right now.
Right. Well, yeah, I would imagine so, because it's, you know, it's good for the borrower and the bank, so you don't get caught. You know, I imagine there was a lot of banks that got caught back in the last, you know, our last downturn, having a lot of loans out there that were below what they're borrowing money at. So,
we're actually borrowing our source of funding is from our deposits. So, you know, as your deposits, you know, what you're paying for your deposits goes up, you have to have, you know, some adjustment features on your loans to be able to maintain your profits. So,
okay. Now, in the event of a default, you know, you just seize the collateralized assets, and there's no other potential repercussions for the borrower.
No, sir. Okay. No, that's the IRA is protected. The customer's protected. When we underwrite these, we don't even pull a credit report.
Okay. Yeah, because I imagine it really wouldn't matter too much, you know, if everything meets that criteria. Yeah. I always kidded with my personal banker back in Minnesota that, you know, I wanted to have some ugly properties that they didn't want back, because it always seemed like they would repo the really cool cars. You know, if you had older, kind of an older station wagon, they just kind of work with you to make the payments on it. and so there's no personal guarantees required whatsoever with these, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, and we've kind of gone through how you look at the collateralization of the assets and, you know, assess them. You know, what areas do you lend in? What parts of the country? I know you were only in Texas for a while, but now you've expanded that, correct?
Yeah, we've expanded into several states here recently. I mean, we've looked at a lot of different deals in a lot of states. We pretty much try to stay out of, you know, some of the, we don't do a lot in New York, New Jersey, but we'll look at, you know, I'm licensed in Tennessee, Arkansas, you know, Alabama, Georgia, we'll do Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma. There's quite a few of them, you know, that we'll do.
Yeah, Arizona.
Arizona.
Okay, up in the West, though. And now, you know, it seems like a lot of banks are very, how do you put it, they really shy away from non-recourse loans. And what is the reason for that? Is just not having the expertise in them, or?
Yeah, I think a lot of, you know, banks, when they hear non-recourse, they just kind of freak out about it. And, you know, the thing about it is with these is we're getting such a large amount of money down on it. You know, I would say that, you know, most banks, if they're doing a non-recourse loan on anything that's not related to a self-directed IRA, they may be getting, you know, maybe 20% down or less. And so I could understand, you know, that there's more risk involved and that the collateral, you know, if it did go down in value, you could have a shortfall. But with this type of deal, you know, with that much money down and you know, it is part of someone's IRA. I mean, the chances of someone defaulting on it are pretty low. And so that's the reason right. why that's the reason why we do it. You know, the other thing that I don't think I mentioned is that, you know, when we underwrite one of these, of course, we're looking at the property itself and the cash flow that it generates. And, you know, typically what we try to do is assess whether or not the property generates about 20% more net operating income than what the debt service would be. So you're looking at what we call a 1.2 target debt service coverage. So we're looking at that. And then the other thing that we're looking at is we're looking at the funds that are in the self-directed IRA, and we're trying to make sure that they have enough reserves in there in the event that, you know, they, let's just say they had a issue with not having a tenant in the property for, you know, a couple of months, or say they had a natural disaster, you know, and they're trying to rebuild the home, whatever, that they may have had an issue where they need to make sure they've got some reserves. And so we typically like to see at least 15% of the loan amount in reserves, post-closing reserves in their IRA. And so that's just, you know, it's kind of one of those deals where you're just trying to make sure that they've got a rainy day fund. Because they can't put money in there, you know, individually, you know, then it gets into it through the IRS. So, you know, they have to have the money in their IRA.
Yeah, and I know that's been an issue with property. I'm going to use Florida as an example, because, you know, in Florida, certain parts of Florida, you're going to get wind damage. It's just, you know, it's kind of a given. It's kind of like, just like, you know, it's going to rain in the afternoon. Yeah. And that people have to, you know, have some type of ability to have funds that can fix that property if something happens without going into debt or taking their own personal money into it. And I know it's happened a lot over the last, I've probably heard it happen more this last year, where people have had to bring in a partner on their property, which they can do, but it's they have to be sure that it's someone who's not a disqualified party. It just makes for a little bit more, you know, some more issues.
Yeah.
You know, and there, so I mean, that's good. I hadn't heard that before from lenders about that, you know, having a little bit extra in there, but that makes sense. That makes sense on there. You know, now if you, you know, look at these, can somebody do like an Airbnb with this? Would you look at that income on an Airbnb as you would a lease?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and what we'll try to do is we'll look at it as an Airbnb, and then we'll also get, you know, what the average monthly rent would be as though it were just being rented out to a normal tenant. And we try to make sure that in those cases that it would at least break even, you know, if it was rented on a month-to-month basis. Most people that buy one, you know, that's going to Airbnb it, I mean, they're doing it because, you know, obviously it should make more money. And so in the event that plan A doesn't work, we just want to make sure that if they go to plan B and just stick a month-to-month person in there, that, you know, it will still generate enough revenue to carry it until the borrower can either decide if they want to keep it or not, you know.
Right. And I know that's just where I think people have to take a look at that, because something, and I'm going to use an example down here in Scottsdale, Arizona, that they're starting to change the laws with the Airbnbs because of all the problems they've had with them, or some of the homeowners associations have changed the rules that people can't rent it on a weekly basis like they used to be able to. And then all of a sudden they have to go through a 30-day or a 60-day minimum rental. And you know, if they've counted on that other money, okay, they've got to be able to, you know, withstand that maybe loss of income.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely need to go into that. You know, if they're going to do an Airbnb, they definitely need to do their homework and know the rules in the city that they're going into. Because I know they do the same thing in Nashville. I believe they put a limit on how many. I think they actually stopped issuing new permits in the city of Nashville, if I understand correctly, where you can't, you know, you can't do another Airbnb. So it's
right.
You know, that you need to go into it eyes wide open and know the market that you're going into for sure.
Right. Well, I know they did that in Kohler. And you wouldn't think a place like Kohler, Wisconsin would have that, you know, problem. But they had all the golfers coming into the, you know, staying there over a week for long weekends and hooping it up. And so they actually stopped Airbnbs except for a few that were able to apply for permits on there. And it's that's something that's, it's a whole, that's a whole, whole other discussion, because that's a part of the real estate industry that's, you know, changed dramatically. Well, everything's changed dramatically now, you know, and that's, and one of the things I think that one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today a little bit was just to kind of clear this up. And your bank's done a marvelous job for our clients. We've had nothing but people that have dealt with you with accounts, or you did a loan for somebody here recently. They had nothing but glowing things to say. We really appreciate that. Yeah, so I wanted to highlight you guys.
I appreciate that. Yeah, we can handle the deposit side of this too. You know, I mean, like we actually offer interest bearing accounts for people that want to park, you know, their IRA funds or checkbook IRA funds over here.
Well, that was gonna be my next little comment here on it too. Is you have one of the few. I don't know of many checking accounts where IRA can get an account to hold their funds and get interest. And it's, you know, and they've got a nice mobile banking platform to be able to do this. So somebody that had their rent, they could actually set up their rental account with you guys and, you know, go right into the bank with the payments and, you know, and sit there and gain some interest on it. So,
absolutely. Yep.
And now, would they contact you for that, or who would they contact for
that? They can contact me. And then we've got another gentleman that helps me. His name is Dayton Mahis. And Dayton actually handles a lot of the deposit stuff. But, you know, any of us, if they contact the bank, we can always, you know, direct them to where they need to go.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I think that's really been nice about your bank, and the clients that have dealt with, is a very down home attitude that, you know, and a lot of the, you know, financial community right now, you know, you go through about 15 people to get to somebody, and probably about three answering bots. That's, you know, you start yelling representative. But I think there's even, isn't there a, you know, an agent branch to have a phone for your CEO that they can call him up if they want to?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, we have a red phone, and somebody can walk into any branch, pick up that phone and call the bank president directly, and he'll answer.
Yeah, and how many people do that?
You know, we have people from time to time that do that. I mean, and most of the time, what's really cool about it is most of the time it's really for compliments. I mean, I don't really know how many complaints he ever gets. You know, most of the time it's always, hey, you know, really appreciate what y'all are doing for us. And, you know, we just try to take care of our people and try to have a, you know, we like the small bank feel. Most people do. And, you know, we have a live person that answers the phone. You know, it's not a robot. We try to answer the phone. You know, that's part of doing business.
Right, right. And I guess it. I mean, I know with my personality, I just pick up the phone just to see if they would really answer. And you'd have to try it out. Our staff, we like to have all our management committee operate on the chat line and do things like that. And sometimes people won't believe it. They'll think it is a bot, or it is a, I had one guy, he says, there's no way I'm talking to one of the owners. I says, yeah, you are.
Yeah.
And I said, call me up right now, or we can get on Zoom. I'll put my camera on. But I mean, I think that's what's nice about your bank, that you've got some very forward thinking services, but able to maintain kind of a down home type of atmosphere. So now, if somebody's listening to this that wants to talk more about this, how do they get a hold of you?
They can call me. I office at the Gonzales branch, and they can call directly here to the branch, and contact me that way. And or I don't mind people calling me on my cell. I mean, I have a cell number too, but my line here at the branch is 830-672-1081.
And what's your email address, Gary?
It's Gary dot mobs MOB as in boy, B as in boy, S as in Sam at southstarbank.com.
Okay, and that also we'll have this on written down on the podcast too, so people are going to be able to see, to see that and put in their day timer. Well, Gary, I really thank you a lot for your spending some time today. I know you guys are busy, and I really appreciate you, taking the time to, share some of your insights with people. Anything I missed? Anything you'd like to say that I missed on here?
I think we covered most of it.
Great,
But if
great.
somebody has a question, they're welcome to reach out, on either one of those contact, either by phone or by email. If they have a direct question, about something, I'd be glad to answer it.
Super. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time.
You bet. Thank you.